This is Truth Jihad Radio, available by subscription at truthjihad.com. I recently horned in on a conversation between Cat April Waters and former CIA officer Ray McGovern. Let's listen in.
We have to go back to our first president, who happened to be a general. His name is Washington. And when he left, he felt it necessary to warn the American people against what he called a passionate attachment of one country, namely ours, to the perceived interests of another country where those interests did not coincide. Now we have that in spades now with respect to how America has reacted or relates to Israel. Bringing it back to today, aboard the Al Auda, this boat that's on its way to Gaza, is a fellow named Joe Medors. Now Joe Medors was on the crew of the USS Liberty when Israeli planes and torpedo boats did their very best to scuttle it, leaving no survivors, on June 8, 1967. The record is complete. The intercepts have been revealed. Plane or aircraft to tower, that's an American flag. Do you really want us to shoot up that ship?
Right.
Tower to aircraft. Yes, sir. Follow your orders, okay? Now, Joe Medors survived that. There were 34 people who were killed. There were 174 who were badly wounded. And that's where it was then, and it's not appreciably different now. American people don't know about that. Why is that? Because of the inordinate influence of Israel on our press. This thing has been put in the secretive places of history, and Joe Medors, to his great credit, is on that boat right now, and we'll see what the Israelis do as this unarmed boat tries to break the siege to Gaza, where 2 million, I say again, 2 million people are on a subsistence diet. The Israelis have actually said this out loud, that we'll give them just enough so they don't starve to death, but we'll make it very difficult and hope that they all just leave. Now, what we have, and I'll just finish with this comment, what we have pure and simple is bald racism, okay? And the Israeli Knesset this past week defined itself, defined Israel as an apartheid state by giving Palestinian citizens, mind you, Palestinian citizens second-rate status. Why is that? Well, in simple terms, they don't look like most of us Americans. They can be made the other, and because of Israel's influence on our body politic and on our media, the people in Gaza can be treated just like the people in Auschwitz. And I do not exaggerate. Auschwitz was a quick death. What the Gazans are suffering is a slow death, but a step nonetheless.
Kevin Barrett, what do you have to say to that?
Well, Israel was founded by terrorists who actually raised terrorism up to a high religious principle. According to Moshe Sharet, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Prime Minister of Israel in the 1950s, they used terrorism against the British, they used terrorism against the indigenous Palestinians, and they've repeatedly used false flag terrorism against the United States and other countries. And they're the world leader in terrorism per capita, in false flag terrorism, and in assassinations. This kind of extreme ruthlessness has been very much a characteristic of Israel's behavior all the way down the line, including, you know, before it was actually officially Israel. It sent mail bombs to President Truman and to British leaders to try and force them to recognize Israel and then bribe Truman with a suitcase full of $2 million in cash. And so Truman had the U.S. accept Israel, even though all of his advisors in the State Department and the military were against it. And so this kind of ruthless behavior against Palestinians and against the rest of the world is par for the course and has been for a very long time. The only question is, why does the world put up with it? And I think the answer to that is the Zionist power configuration, as sociologist James Petras calls it, has got a death grip on all of the key Western institutions. Jews with a certain degree of loyalty to Israel, varying degrees, of course, and varying outlooks on Israel, dominate the mainstream and alternative medias here in the United States and in Europe. The political money flowing into our political system has been estimated at nearly half of it is coming from Zionists, with Zionist strings attached. Formerly, the Republicans only got about a third of their money from Zionists, and the Democrats got more than half, but now it's evened out. And we have many billionaires, hundreds of millionaires, and about 500,000 foot soldiers, that is full-time hardcore Zionist zealots, working overtime to smear anyone who gets in the way of the Zionist project here in the United States. And all of this is described in great detail by Petras in his work on the ZPC, the Zionist power configuration. So I think we Americans need to recognize that we need an intifada right here at home. The Zionists have taken from us trillions of dollars, well over $1 trillion, according to, I think it was a 2002 estimate that was cited and essentially recognized as correct by the Christian Science Monitor. It's much higher than that now because the 9/11 wars, which are disguised wars for Israel, have cost the U.S. $5 or perhaps even $6 trillion or more and counting. And they're trying to drag us into more conflicts, including one with Iran. Finally, I think we need to recognize that, like the USS Liberty incident, the 9/11 false flag event was unquestionably largely driven by Zionists as part of their strategy that was laid out in the document drawn up for Benjamin Netanyahu a few years before that, the Clean Break document, and then it was rehabbed as if it were really about American imperial power in PNAC's document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, issued exactly 1 year, almost to the day, before the September 11th false flag event drove the U.S. into a series of wars for Israel. So we Americans, if we recognize these facts, we, like the Palestinians, are going to have to rise up against Zionist power in an intifada right here at home.
Right. We don't want to wait until we're, you know, in the position the Palestinians are in before, okay, like, you know, you think it's time to stand up now? You know, don't wait that long. But I just...
Catherine?
Yeah. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, Catherine, I'm thinking back at when I first learned about what was going on in Palestine. I was 9 years old in 1948. Growing up in the Bronx, New York City.
Yeah.
And when I heard, and when everyone in the Bronx heard, that Israel had its own country, oh, there was great rejoicing, there were parades, there was nobody was told that there were already people there, that there were 700,000 Palestinians uprooted from their homes and want to return. Now, that's why this boat headed to Gaza is called Al-Auda. It's Arabic for return. Now, what am I getting at here? I'm getting at the fact that, you know, we really have been brainwashed into thinking that Israel is, quote, the sole democracy in the Middle East. My God. They are an apartheid regime as concretized by the law passed this past week by the Knesset, okay? And the last thing I want to do in terms of throwing some realism on history, which most people in America don't know, is this. Most people think, as the Israelis claimed, that Nasser and the Arabs were about to attack Israel in June of 1967, when the Israelis decapitated all the surrounding countries, including Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Now, you know, when you get really, really headstrong and you think, well, I don't have to, I don't have to disguise what happened anymore. You can actually brag about what happened. And what we have is Benjamin, not Benjamin Netanyahu, but rather Menachem Begin.
Yeah.
Bragging about how, you know, he said, and I'll paraphrase it here, he said, you know, we have to be honest. It wasn't that Nasser and his troops were threatening Israel. We knew that wasn't the case. We saw an opportunity here to rearrange the borders, and that's what happened in 1967. Benjamin Netanyahu admitted that in this major speech, was actually carried by the New York Times. And what never happens is anyone refers to Resolution 242 of the United Nations.
Ray?
Unanimously passed.
Okay, that's better.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sorry, I was just gonna, you know, say, like, move the speaker, like, a little bit further from, you know, your mouth, cause it was just getting a little bit muffled, but it just cleared up. Just as
okay,
I.
Okay, good.
Okay, that's good. Go ahead.
Yeah, well,
sorry, didn't
you know, it's just amazing how little Americans typically know about Israel, how it was created, how it drove, almost a million Palestinians out of their homes, how there are more Palestinians living in Israeli-occupied territory and Israel itself than Israelis themselves, and that the occupied territories have been populated now by settlements surrounded by Israeli armed forces in an attempt to drive the Palestinians out or drive them crazy. And so, since this is unknown to most of my educated brethren here who read the New York Times but don't see it in the New York Times, it is a tribute to you, Catherine, and to Kevin and others who call a spade a spade and show that genocide, and that's the proper word here, genocide against the people in Gaza should not be allowed.
Yep.
And if some of the people who worked for Barack Obama were likely to say, oh, we have a responsibility to protect the Libyans, right?
Yeah.
Or other people where we want to invade or regime change.
Yep.
Well, what about the responsibility to protect the people in Gaza?
Right.
What's the Sixth Fleet doing? Sitting offshore there, do they not have the courage
exactly.
to make sure that the U.S. boat and the other boats that try to get to Gaza get through the blockade? It's a shameful policy.
See, that's,
and Trump is among the worst following it.
Right, like what, you know, when are people going to just stop following orders? I mean, at what point, like as an adult human, you know, like I mean, well, you know. I mean, clearly people are not free thinking, critical thinking people if all they're going to do is just blindly follow orders. And I mean, this is what I don't understand. Like, when are people going to just like stop following orders and think for yourself? And we can't, if you know, because if we're going to continue to blame the people at the top and wait for them to change before you know, things change. I mean, that's never going to happen. The people are the ones.
Yeah.
I mean, they were saying that over and over and over again at the meetings. You know, I mean, I did the legs around Spain, and when we would have meetings with parliament members, and, you know, that's what everybody was sharing. You know, the governments are not going to do anything. The people have to do it.
Well, that's it. You know, we just need to step up, and the hope is in what we call the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. Now, people, and I include all my former colleagues in CIA, there was no one, not one person who thought that there would be a change in regime in South Africa without a bloodbath, okay? But it didn't happen that way, did it? And what was the pressure? The pressure came from us, led by African Americans, led by us, and boycotting and surrounding the Israeli, the South African embassy. We can make this work if we persuade our American co-patriots here that this is not this is not a conscionable U.S. policy. We can boycott Israeli goods and make them hurt economically, so at least they will think twice about continuing to oppress the Palestinian people, as they have carte blanche to do so now.
I wanted to, also bring in Julian Assange, because I feel like it's appropriate, because the media doesn't tell the true story, and here they're crucifying this one guy. I mean, I'm not an expert on what Julian Assange says about Israel-Palestine, but I do know that the media in this country spins it and tries to make the Palestinians look like the aggressors. And a really good documentary to watch is The Occupation of the American Mind, for anybody that hasn't seen that. Kevin, what do you want to say about the media? And, I know that they are controlled by Israel in this country.
Well, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is the media sets limits on what can or cannot be said, what discourse is acceptable and what isn't. That's its main job. And so it stakes out a spectrum of acceptable discourse on this question. And that spectrum is set in order to favor the Zionists. And I think it's interesting that one can get away with bemoaning the fate of the suffering Palestinians to a great extent, and do that in the alternative media, which is full of people who are to some degree sympathetic with Zionism. And one can even do it to a certain extent in parts of the mainstream media. And I think there's a reason for the fact that is acceptable. That's because ultimately the American people who are living in this discursive framework defined by the media are really never going to get upset enough, unfortunately, about the suffering of the Palestinians to get something done about it. But what we're not allowed to talk about is Zionist control of the United States of America, because if the American people had the faintest inkling of what's being done to them by the Zionists in this country, they would rise up and burn down Washington, D.C., that's why I think it's so important that we try to get the concealed facts of history out there. And I'd like to ask Ray about the issue of what was going on as the Zionists were taking over the United States in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Eisenhower's CIA director, or rather CIA, I guess John McCone, was working as the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, that's right, under Eisenhower. And then he was appointed head of the CIA under JFK. McCone had leaked to the New York Times the story about Israel's Dimona nuclear weapons project. And McCone and Kennedy were absolutely determined to shut down Israel's nuclear program and to make sure that Israel never had nuclear weapons. Michael Collins Piper's book, Final Judgment, makes a pretty good argument that was the single biggest factor that led to the murder of John F. Kennedy in a coup d'etat that was primarily organized by people with CIA ties who were actually working with the Zionists, with James Jesus Angleton, who has a huge statue honoring him in Tel Aviv today, being one of the key figures. He was the CIA counterintelligence chief, and he was apparently an Israeli mole. So we've had essentially the Zionists sent letter bombs, mail bombs, to try and kill President Truman. They murdered President Kennedy. They then put their agent, their lifelong asset of the Kosher Nostra crime syndicate, Lyndon Johnson, in the White House, who then conspired with Israel to murder Americans on the USS Liberty, attempting to murder all of the hundreds of Americans on that ship. and the Israelis continued attacking the United States in various ways, up to and including the September 11th massacre. I think if the American people knew this, they would quickly change their attitude towards the so-called Israel-Palestine question. But they will never know this because the media, especially the alternative media, and including many fora in which you work, Ray, make sure that these truths, these historical facts, are never even discussed. And I think we have to break down those barriers and make sure that those facts do get discussed in order to get the American people to change American policy. I'd like to know what you think about that, Ray.
Well, I have discussed these things ad nauseam. I regret that you haven't heard them, Kevin. But the business about the Israeli nuclear capability is one of the most shameful things. And I agree, there is a good argument that that factor played into the assassination of John Kennedy. There are lots of reasons that they wanted to get John Kennedy, and it was James Jesus Angleton and his cohorts in CIA, FBI, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff that did Kennedy in. So this is all part of history. It's hidden history because no people have been able to really be convinced of this. But you're right. Once American people were able to understand. Now, let's take Syria as a more recent example. Why was the United States so interested in making sure that there was bedlam, there in Syria, that Bashar al-Assad, quote, had to go, end quote? Well, that was pure and simple a policy driven by Israeli interests, pure and simple. And you know, not often does the New York Times report this, but they did. Look at it. September 6th. 2013, Jody Ruderin, bureau chief in Tel Aviv, New York Times, front page story. I went, she said, to senior Israeli policymakers, and I said, what's your preferred outcome in Syria? And I was told by the most senior people, including the former consul general in New York, Jody, this doesn't sound very humanitarian, but our preferred outcome is no outcome. Ruderin, no outcome? What do you mean no outcome? And the answer came back from this person, high level Israeli consul general, former in New York, said, look, as long as the blood hemorrhages, as long as the Sunni and Shia are at each other's throats in Syria, we look at it as a kind of a playoff game where you don't want either team to lose and you don't want either team to win. As long as this carnage continues, quote, Israel has nothing to fear from Syria, period, end quote. Now, the muckety-mucks at the New York Times were all out in the Hamptons sipping martinis on that week. It was a Labor Day weekend. And so somebody with some courage slipped that article as the lead article on September 6, 2013. Nothing like it has been seen before or since, but that's the reality. You want to know why people have been killed? Why almost a million people, Syrians, have been killed, including Syrian armed forces? Well, it's because of our policy at the behest of Israel. They can't do much by themselves, but they can sure do a heck of a lot by deceiving the United States into supporting this kind of carnage. That is a matter of history. It's very recent history. But unless you tune into the New York Times on that one particular day, you know nothing about it.
Exactly. Getting the information to people is just like so crucial. I wish I knew how to do it. It's hard to, it's hard to get people to believe this stuff. It's hard to get people to believe that, you know, their own country would do things like 9/11 and, you know, I post things, you know, people like kind of attack me on social media, you know, calling people who question the official 9/11 story nuts. And, you know, to me, it's just, it's so like obvious, really. This really obvious. Kevin, talk about, you know, what you know. Actually, let me see. I have your bio here. I had it up just really a second ago. And, Ray, you know, who's also, you've been with the CIA, former CIA analyst for like something like 30 years. So you're, you know, very aware of this stuff. You've been active and, rallying and, you know, protesting for, you know, for some years now. And, you know, Kevin Barrett, Dr. Kevin Barrett, PhD, Arabist, Islamologist, holds advanced degrees in English literature, French literature, African literature, the author of three books, including Questioning the War on Terror, For Obama's Voters, which deconstructs the war on terror through Socratic questioning. You also a lead editor along with John Cobbs and Sandra Lubarsky of 9/11 and American Empire, V2 Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. And you taught the French and Arabic languages, African literature, English humanities, religious studies, and folklore at colleges and universities in the U.S. and abroad. And you've been a Muslim since 1993. I mean, does anybody, I don't know, what can we do to get this information out? Like, what I wanted to do was maybe have a, I don't know if this is going to do any good, you know, in front of Chuck Schumer and Gillibrand up there on Third Avenue. They've tried this before. And, you know, ask them to support the flotilla. You know, I don't know if these things are going to work. I mean, we've done things like this before for Israel-Palestine. What are we going to do to get the message out, to get people informed?
Well, you know, I think Ray is doing terrific work in kind of putting his body on the line at some of these events and getting some coverage, and, you know, generally fairly sympathetic coverage out of it. So I salute you, Ray, for that. And, you know, I've been thinking that maybe it's time to get back off the internet into the streets. When I first started doing 9/11 activism was in the 1980s. I was going door to door, knocking on doors for the Sane Freeze anti-nuclear bomb campaign. And, did a better part of a year of that, and then kind of retired from activism and went back to literary studies. Then, after 9/11, I read David Ray Griffin and recognized that he was right and that we'd been the victims of a colossal hoax. I started working on that issue, doing teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin, and quickly discovered that I actually could reach a lot more people through the alternative media on the internet than talking to people one by one at the teach-in out on the University of Wisconsin campus. So I've been focusing on work on the internet and on book publishing since 2006, when I was run out of the academy on a rail by the usual suspects. And now I'm thinking that maybe in the era of internet censorship, which it's time to focus on trying to get back into the real world a little bit. And one way to do this might be to actually protest internet censorship in person in at live events. I'm thinking of maybe declaring free speech zones. In other words, you get a t-shirt or a sandwich board and maybe a sign that says free speech zone, and you explain to people that YouTube is now taking down videos telling the truth about current events in history, that Facebook is blocking websites that tell the truth about real events in history, such as the Veterans Today website that I work with, and that Google is making sure that nobody sees any URLs of articles and so on that tell the truth about current events in history. There's been this massive anti-so-called fake news campaign driven by Trump, who, of course, occasionally speaks the truth in saying Bush was responsible for 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. But usually Trump is even more out to lunch than the mainstream media is, but they've used him as an excuse to crack down on the alternative movements as supposed Nazis. And now the internet is becoming a dissent free zone. So maybe we need to protest that by going out in person, and doing, more face-to-face activism. At least that's what I'm thinking of doing. And we do need to find a way to protest this internet censorship. And since the internet itself is now censored, it's getting harder and harder to do that by way of the internet. So maybe we need to get out there in person, and maybe these direct action, you know, face-to-face kinds of information activism actions can help awaken people. And I know, Ray, you're doing a lot of these consistently, and I think maybe people like me who've been hiding out behind our computers need to follow your example.
Well, Kevin, thanks for sharing that. You know, I do think that that there are more of us than most people believe or are conscious of. One of my favorite theologians, Annie Dillard, said, "You know, who shall come out and come up the mountain? There is only us. There never has been any other." And I think that's true. And so, what you also say about direct action, I think there are enough of us. And what I'd like to get beyond is all the hand-wringing and all the complaining. I cite something that I call the Noah principle, after the Noah of the Bible, okay? And the principle is this: no more awards for predicting rain, awards only for building arcs. Now, we have to build some arcs. And you know, there aren't enough prisons, even here in Washington, D.C., to hold all of us. If the time has come for us to put our bodies into it. Now, there will be all kinds of attempts to repress us. But when push comes to shove, and I mean that literally, is the regime here in Washington going to be able to depend on the D.C. police? No, not at all. They're part of the 99%. How about the Capitol Police? No, they're not going to be able to depend on them either. How about the Secret Service? Well, there aren't enough of them, and many of them are sort of hobnobbing with the muckety-mucks. So why is it that Obama passed the law, signed a law, that allows the United States Army to surround the Capitol when we appear in our millions and arrest us? Reversing a law passed after the Civil War, when people in the South were using the U.S. Army for nefarious purposes. Why is it that Obama signed that law? It's called the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, why is it? Well, the simple answer is that under the impact of the protests in Wall Street and all the other places, the powers that be had a little fit of panic and said, what happens? What happens when they surround the Capitol? What happens when we can't go home to Georgetown for our martinis? What happens when we call on the D.C. police or the Capitol police and they say, no, sorry, we're part of the 99%? Well, at that point, they're going to call in the U.S. Army. And that's where it's going to come push to shove. Will the Army obey orders to repress their brothers and sisters like us from the outside? I don't know the answer to that. But if we don't force that issue, we'll never find out. And we'll go into the dustbin of history as a bunch of cowards that didn't face up to the oppression that was right before our faces.
Amen. I think that this is a good time for me to interject that, you know, I come from this at a completely, you know, different angle than both of you guys, because, you know, it was my upbringing that woke me up a long time ago. And it was clear because it was right in everyone's face. You know, it was a dysfunctional, abusive environment. I mean, it was clear people are not on each other's side. And the person, you know, me, that was like speaking the truth and speaking out against abuse, I was the one that got criminalized, like, you know, continuously for years. And, you know, I call it the micro version of the banks get bailed out, the people get sold out. The abuser got excuses made for them, and the bill was getting put on the person that was bringing the awareness and being, you know, the whistleblower, which is kind of like why I'm so passionate about this stuff, because I've been silenced and criminalized since the early 70s. For, you know, just trying to speak out about abuse in the family system. And now I feel like we're living in a mass version of that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of enabling. The public is very enabling of the people in power. They wouldn't be able to do what they do, you know, if, you know, people, right, like, you know, resisted them, did what there is, it's in their right to do. Like, the public doesn't even seem to know that it's their right to do this.
That's what I mean by building arcs, okay? Those of us who are in a position to be able to do this need to figure out ways not to keep complaining, but to make sure that we put our whole selves in, including our bodies. And as Kevin suggested, however small scale we start, with placards, sandwich boards, or whatever, there need to be free speech zones, because people in this country are beginning to suffer, and they know that it's not their own fault. People are being oppressed. And when people get oppressed, they need leadership. And that's the kind of thing we need to exert. We need to find ways. I am confident we will, because of a basic faith in the good nature and the courage of the American people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, exactly. Like, what kind of person do you want to be? What are you made out of? That's what I was always, you know, what are you made out of?
Well, I think the American people are very decent at heart, and maybe their biggest fault is being too easily manipulated. I don't know if you guys have seen this Sacha Baron Cohen series of films about him playing the role of an Israeli Mossad anti-terror trainer coming to Washington, and he succeeded in getting interviews with a whole bunch of big-time American Congress critters and duping them into going along with his antics under the pretext that he's a Mossad terror trainer. And the things that he got these politicians to do and say, really, it's not only darkly hilarious, but it reveals the way that these types of sort of Likudnik Israeli psychopathic monsters are able to wrap American politicians around their little fingers. That's not only because our politicians are corrupt, of course they are, but they're also kind of almost innocent in a kind of childlike way. You know, the French have a saying that les Américains sont des grands enfants. Americans are just big children or big babies. And, you know, Trump is kind of the ultimate big baby, as that blimp flying over London indicated. And that childlike or childish character, I think, you know, it's both the childish kind of me, you know, terrible twos kind of Trump persona, but there's also a kind of an innocent and actually well-meaning childlike nature to the American people as well. And that's why I think they have been so badly brainwashed by an elite that I think is functionally psychopathic. You know, I think that the history of, you know, post-Christian civilization is one in which sort of the earlier era of Christianity being the framework for, you know, all of society then gave way to the government, the Caesar that you're supposed to, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Well, that Caesar becomes openly psychopathic with Machiavelli. And so since then, leaders have been invited really to behave in a way that violates ordinary people's morality. And this process has gotten worse and worse and worse. And now in this sort of post 9/11 era, where the powers that be are infinitely cynical and most people are somewhere between naive and jaded, you know, I think we need to kind of make that connection for people that their basic decency is being violated constantly by the people in power. And I think people are starting to get that. The official discourse is losing its magical hold over people's minds. And I don't think Trump could have been elected in any earlier year, because it's only now that the mainstream media's authority has been eroded so much that everybody knows that the mainstream is lying. And so some naive folks believe that maybe Trump was telling the truth when he was attacking the mainstream media and being attacked in turn. So I think people are decent and well-meaning and now ready to see that their leaders are lying, that the dominant discourse is one big lie, and that, you know, there's a potential for a huge change, and it's going to require some kind of catalyst. As Ray said, it's going to take leadership. However, I'm concerned, though, because all of the leadership is at this point much more cowardly than the followers. You know, from the pulpits, there are maybe two or three people from the pulpits who've been able to preach 9/11 truth, and I think two out of three lost their jobs. Anybody who has something to lose, whether it's in an alternative media gig where you're actually making some money from the Soros Foundation, you have your salary paid to be pseudo opposition, or whether it's, you know, any kind of in the academy, anywhere where you have anything to lose, it's made clear to you that if you tell the full truth, you're going to lose what you have. And most of the people who are in the quote unquote leadership positions, and that includes the most Muslim community, actually, it's worse than anywhere else there, because the leaders in the Muslim community are terrorized. And like the polls show that 2/3 of American Muslims know 9/11 was an inside job. And yet you can't say this in a mosque anywhere in America, with a handful of exceptions, because the leadership will chase you out of the mosque because they're terrified of the authorities and of the Zionists. So our leadership right now is profoundly compromised. We're going to have to find a way for some real leadership to arise that will catalyze the kind of huge change that we could get as the people lose faith in their mainstream institutions.
Yeah, in a sense, any goer is right. There is only us. There never has been any other. One parallel with World War II, of course, is that the moral leaders that one would normally look to, the religious leaders, for example. Well, we all know how the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church bowed to Hitler during the Third Reich, how they could not find their voice. Well, they can't find their voice now either. And the first thing we need to do is recognize that and not keep fighting it, as I fought for about 20 years. It finally dawned on me that that was a waste of energy. In Catholic theology, we call it an occasion of sin. I was wasting my energy on fighting the hierarchy. We have to depend on ourselves here. We have to realize that we can't expect the leaders of our faith communities to do what we have to do ourselves. And, you know, most people don't know these kinds of things, but in researching all this business, and you probably know this, Kevin, yourself, after the war, now when I say the war, I was alive for all of World War II. I was very, very young, but I was alive. You know, the war. After the war, the Dominicans in a monastery in France invited Albert Camus, the French philosopher, to lecture to them. And they asked him, tell us, Albert, what do you think of how the moral leadership exerted itself during World War II? And he said, and I quote, you know, you will find this difficult to believe because I am an unbeliever. But I kept waiting for a voice from Rome. From home, and no voice came. Now, after the war, some of my colleagues said, you are wrong, Albert. There was a voice from home in the form of an encyclical. And so I said, what is an encyclical? And they said it was the biggest pronouncement from the Vatican. And they said various things during the war. And so Camus said to these Dominicans, now whose fault is it? I ask you, whose fault is it that these pronouncements come in such a form that no one, even highly educated people like me, can understand or even be aware of? Shame. Shame on you moral leaders. Now, I extrapolate from that to the present circumstances in this country where moral leadership is lacking on the part of virtually all faith leaders. And that's all the more reason why it's really up to us. And we have to stop complaining about it. We have to stop wasting our energy on it, as I did for so many decades. We have to realize that unless we take the cudgel here, unless we take the ball, nothing's going to happen. But that there are enough of us. I really believe that there are enough of us. And so what you need to do, April, is to get this thing out and around and have people listen to it and say, well, are we up to this or are we not?
Yeah.
And my firm conviction is that the American people are up to it.
Yeah, we need major social fitness.
Amen.
Okay.
I'm afraid I have to leave now, Catherine. So
thank you, Ray.
Kevin, it's been terrific talking to you.
Likewise, I admire you. I really hope you keep walking your path for a while, because we're going to need you. The people with your courage, especially people with your background, are very few and far between.
Well, thanks a lot. And take care now, all. Bye now.
Okay, bye. So, Kevin, then let me ask you, what are your feelings about what, Trump was saying to the leader of Iran, and pulling the lion's tail, I forget what his name is, was telling Trump, don't pull the lion's tail and provoking war with Iran.
Right. That was this tweet storm back and forth between Trump and Rouhani, the president of Iran, that in some ways followed, the model of the earlier tweet war between Trump and Kim about North Korea. We had essentially the same kind of language with Trump, threatening Iran, the same thing he threatened Kim, which is like devastation beyond anything that, hardly any people have ever suffered, and this sort of thing. it's so bizarre. I mean, the Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. But, Trump has tiny little hands and a tiny little stick, but he sure doesn't speak softly. He tweets at the top of his lungs, thinking that he's some kind of blustery mobster who's cutting a deal with somebody, and if he terrorizes them and, bloviates all over them, that they're going to roll over and give him a better deal. That's his sense of how the world works, because that's the milieu he's been in. A bunch of, overweight slob mobster types that he deals with in his money laundering hotel casino operations, and that's basically what he's done all his life, is he's been a front man for the mafia. He was started out, he's given his start by Roy Cohn, who is the mob's man in New York City. And that's all Trump's ever done. That's all he ever knows. But now he's totally out of his league because, it's true that the people who rule the world at the political level are a kind of organized crime syndicate, but they're a classier syndicate than the people Trump's been hanging out with. So he's really in, way out of his depth. And so he's, making a comic spectacle of himself with these insane tweets. And that's kind of how Rouhani responded to him, saying that, we're not impressed, and we've been around a lot longer, or we had an empire here in Iran a lot longer than America has had a country, and we'll be around probably a long time after America's gone. So what this is really about, though, is that Trump seems to be on a collision course with Iran, which is completely insane strategically. Everything Trump is doing is strategically insane from a standpoint of a sophisticated manager of the American empire. Obama was working for people who were much more sophisticated. And so Obama was corralling all of the U.S. allies together in Europe, and he was corralling the U.S. allies together in the Trans-Pacific Partnership to shut out China. You know, he had a strategy. And of course, Obama knew what Brzezinski writes in the Grand Chessboard, that the United States absolutely has to be friends with Iran, because otherwise, if Iran is on the side of Russia, China, and the heartland, which is the geopolitical entity that's against the U.S., British, and maybe to some extent Japanese rimland, then it's all done. It's finished. But Trump doesn't understand that because he's a Zionist mafia kosher Nostra frontman, and he just does what they tell him to do. And the kosher Nostra is a bunch of unsophisticated hacks who basically think that the more genocidal Israel behaves, the better off Israel will be. And that's all they care about. They don't care whether the U.S. empire survives long enough to protect Israel another decade. They're too stupid to even have that concern, or at least a lot of them are. Not all of them. So Trump has been sucked into this posture of making nice with North Korea and essentially recognizing North Korea as a de facto permanent nuclear weapon state, which is what Trump's meeting with Kim essentially sealed. Trump, you know, they're lying, and Trump in particular is totally avoiding the reality that that's what he did. He just gave North Korea the right to be a permanent nuclear weapon state. North Korea didn't sign up to anything that they haven't already promised a million times over and broken their promises. They're not getting rid of anything. And then Trump went to Moscow and did the bidding of his handlers in the Russian mafia, which is a major, maybe the dominant faction of today's kosher Nostra, the ethnically Jewish organized crime syndicate that's probably the biggest single deep state force on the planet. And all of this was in service to putting the problems with Korea and Russia on hold in hopes of going after Iran. And so Trump is surrounded by two guys, Bolton and Pompeo, who are dedicated to trying to have a war with Iran on behalf of the extreme hardline faction in Israel. And so that's the direction that Trump is headed right now. But I don't think it's going to work, because I don't think that Trump can muster the will on the part of the West in general, and the U.S. in particular, to jump into a serious war on Iran for Israel. I don't think that's politically going to fly. Trump is very unpopular. The people who voted for Trump voted for him because Trump told the truth that the Iraq war was a disaster, Libya was a disaster, Syria was a disaster, no more U.S. intervention in the Middle East. That's what they voted for when they voted for Trump. And the people who didn't vote for Trump hate his guts. So who's going to support him if he goes to war on Iran? Nobody. I mean, maybe for the first week when there's all a big hoopla, you know, they'll rear up some kind of false flag and say the Iranians sunk an American ship or something like that. And yeah, there'll be maybe a war fever for a little while, but it will quickly dissipate. And the U.S. will not have the chops to sustain any effort against Iran. And Iran, on the other hand, the minute it's in a serious fight with the United States and or Israel, the Iranian people are going to mobilize behind their government, and they will stay mobilized as long as it takes, even if it takes decades. We saw that kind of will in their mobilization against Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was weaponized and armed with chemical weapons by the United States and sent against Iran in a war of aggression. The Iranian people, who were in total chaos at that time after the revolution, essentially had no military at all, rallied and ended up defeating Iraq. And they would have taken Iraq and they would have taken Baghdad if the United States had not shot down their civilian airliner, murdering hundreds of women and children as a signal that the U.S. was going to mass murder Iranian civilians if Iran didn't call off that march to Baghdad. So Iran is a formidable force, and Trump is not. So this is heading towards being a debacle for the United States. Unfortunately, it's possible that a lot of Iranians might get killed, but in terms of whoever ultimately comes out ahead in that conflict, it's definitely going to be Iran.
And Pompeo was the one calling Iran like a mafia government.
Yeah, what a joke. It's, of course, I tweeted
to him, yeah, it's like looking in a mirror, ain't it?
Well, yeah, but see, the thing is that the truth is exactly the opposite. The truth is that the U.S. and Iran are kind of mirror images of each other, in that in the U.S. there's not so much corruption at the lower levels, but at the highest levels, it is nothing but corruption. And in Iran, it's the opposite. In Iran, there's plenty of corruption at the lower and mid levels, but at the highest level, it's run by people of integrity. The Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei was in fact chosen for that role because he was known to have very high integrity, and he didn't want the position, and he tried to turn it down, and he was essentially forced into it. And those are the kind of people that you want in power, people who don't want the power. He's a profoundly pious and religious man, as was the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, and the people around him are likewise relatively pious, religious, and moral and ethical. Whereas Trump is precisely the opposite. Trump is a perfect image of the utterly amoral, ruthless, you know, pussy-grabbing mafiosi. And likewise with Pompeo and Bolton. Bolton, by the way, was divorced when his wife sued him because he subjected her to mass gang rape at Plato's Retreat in New York. That was how he got his kicks. So these people are scum. They are the scum of the earth. Leadership of Iran is basically decent and moral. People of Iran recognize that and will rally behind their leadership. The people of the United States increasingly recognize that their leadership is psychopathic. And if Trump is stupid enough to get into a war with Iran, I think he'll quickly find out that the people of the United States will not stand behind him for very long.
I wanted to just mention, Dean Henderson is supposed to be joining at 7:30.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I am going to have to leave you and Dean because I have to jump on the line with Cynthia McKinney right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right this second, or can I just say one quick thing?
Yeah. In a minute.
I wanted to just mention Mikko Peleg. You know, in his book The General's Son, he talks about himself when he was in the IDF, and he was also into martial arts, and he was comparing the IDF and their training with martial arts, you know, and the contrast of, you know, the IDF and their aggression, and, you know, martial arts, you know, which is what made me get into fitness and yoga practice and things like that. You know, it's like, you know, balance and compassion and that's what a good leader should possess. They should be learning these like techniques and mediating skills, and they should be having the highest quality of like relationship skills. And instead, they're the biggest psychos are in power. I mean, you know, and again, I was saying it in the 70s, and it's like now it's on this like grand scale. But yeah.
Well, Mikko Peled would, you know, if he were the prime minister of Israel, I would suddenly become a fan of that country, assuming he were actually making the decisions and running the place. I think he could solve the problems very quickly. He's very much a very decent guy. And like you say, spiritually balanced, you know, really everything sort of that the average Israeli in the street doesn't seem to be. But anyway, I'm very, very sorry, April. I really have to run right now. I'm about to jump into a conversation with Cynthia McKinney.
I said hi.
Okay, hello. I will say hello to her and say hi to Dean Henderson for me.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett. What your website is?
That's truthjihad.com.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett.
Okay, take care.
Okay, you too.